What's up, martial artists? Welcome to Black Belt, a martial arts lifestyle podcast. I'm your host, Harinder Singh, and we're going to bridge the gap between sport, tradition, and reality. Join me as I sit down with world-class practitioners to discuss their lifestyles, to teach you about their mindset, training, and fighting methods so that we can grow from their wisdom. My guest this episode is Scott Coker, who is an Ernie Reyes protege, 8th degree black belt, and an original member of the famous West Coast demo team. He was the founder and CEO of Strikeforce and is the current president of Bellator MMA. As a martial artist and promoter of combat sports since 1985, Mr. Coker has firsthand experience being a part of the evolution and transformation of martial arts through combat sports. This episode is all about the scientific study and evolution of martial arts, from karate to kickboxing to mixed martial arts. We dive deep into the last 30 years of MMA evolution, beginning with no rounds, next to no rules, and no weight classes to the current product we have now. We dive deep into the evolution, starting off with the striking arts, then the BJJ revolution to the rise of wrestling. Now, it is all about the flow of the striking, wrestling, and BJJ arts, and the champions of the future will be those who can flow and transition between the styles and fuse them together as one molecule instead of separate entities. We also discuss leadership and how martial arts philosophy has influenced Scott's ability to lead organizations, fighters, and himself. Mr. Coker is a treasure trove of martial arts history, knowledge, and insight. What I appreciate most about him is that there's no separation between martial arts and life. He carries himself as a martial artist everywhere he goes. He is a black belt in life. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Black Belt Podcast. I'm your host, Harinder Singh, and today I'm joined by a very special guest, an Ernie Reyes Sr. protege, 8th degree black belt, and an original member of the famous West Coast demo team. He's the founder and CEO of Strikeforce and the current president of Bellator. Welcome to the show, Mr. Scott Coker.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It was a real pleasure and honor to finally get a chance to sit down and talk to you. I grew up spending a lot of time attending your Strikeforce events back in San Jose. And as a matter of fact, once upon a time, I was an engineer in the Silicon Valley in the early 2000s. And when I made the transition from a more traditional karate background to start to get into more kickboxing and stuff, I started at AKA with Javier Mendez. That's where I got my first kickboxing lessons, and then started watching, going to the Strikeforce events that used to be held at the Civic Center in San Jose before you guys went over to the main arena over there. So it's been an amazing thing to watch your creation and how it's grown into what it is today. But I would love to take a moment to go back to see how it all started and talk a little bit about your journey. And so the benefit of everybody listening, because as you may know, our audience has traditional martial artists, it has sport martial artists, it has reality-based combative martial artists. But the goal of the podcast is to bring together, unite the martial arts world and unite them, bridge. Because together we for us it's a lifestyle, it's a way of life, it's not just a hobby. And that's why I'm really excited to sit down and talk to you today.
Yeah, you know, it's been quite a journey. And when I think about, you know, the path that, you know, I've been very fortunate to be on for the last, let's say, 37, 38 years, is quite fascinating. And I think that we did some great work, you know, with many of these different leagues, Strikeforce Kickboxing before that. Before that, it was West Coast Productions Presents Championship Kickboxing. But how it all started really was when I walked into Master Reyes' school in 1974, I think I was 11 years old. And I just fell in love with martial arts. It really is what it was. It's like, I just couldn't wait to go to class. I used to take two classes a day sometimes. And, you know, sometimes my mom would drop me off and I'd stay until watch the end of the last black belt class get over. I'd be that kid hiding, looking through the peephole, you know, watching the black belt class. And, you know, back then it was like when I remember Master Che was teaching a class and Master Reyes was in the class, Master Thompson was in the class, and all the top black belts that were my teachers were in this class. And what they would do is, if class started at 8:30, they would lock the door at 8:30. And then everybody else is out. And so I'm really hiding in the corner waiting for my mom to show up or my dad to show up, watching these, you know, this amazing, you know, martial artists practice, compete, spar, you know, and work their craft. And really it was fascinating. And really I fell in love with martial arts when I became a student of Master Reyes's back in the 70s. And to see, you know, I know there was so much history before me, obviously, but just to see the history of what I experienced growing up was something I just loved. I feel like my brain's filled with so many great memories, so many great fights, so many great events, so many pivoting points, I think even historically in the combat sports area that it's something that's been a lifelong journey. And I'm so fortunate that I get to continue it with Bellator.
So, you know, you came up at a very legendary time. You know, I think that time in the 70s and the early 80s when martial arts was, you know, not just starting to take off, you know, the Bruce Lee movies were there, the Kung Fu movies were there. And it was the first demo team that you guys were a part of that was going around the country showing and showcasing it. What was that experience like at that time?
You know, I'll tell you, you don't realize what it is until you're older and you're looking back and you go, wow, what a great experience. You know, like we went to all the top tournaments around the country. We went to Long Beach Internationals first in 77, I believe. And then we went to the Diamond Nationals. We went to Roy Kerbin's tournament in Texas. In Oklahoma, went to the Century tournament that they used to hold back in the day. But Long Beach was the big hub. I believe that there was a tournament in the East Coast that we went to. So we got to compete and travel the tournaments circuit, and you get to do it with your best friends that you train with every day, right? And, you know, to Master Reyes's credit, it's like, you know, to me, he was a visionary in the sense that we grew up in a very traditional style, right? And, you know, back then in the 70s, it was like, you're either the Taekwondo guy or you're the Kung Fu guy or you're the Jiu-Jitsu guy, Judo guy. There's no cross mingling of any of these martial artists or martial arts. And so basically you stuck to your style. And our style was Taekwondo. So we would do, you know, work on mostly Taekwondo. But when we started traveling, then he started putting in some weaponry. He started putting in some music. He started putting in some, you know, theatrics and made it like an entertainment show, basically, that I think that the people that were there in the martial arts tournaments appreciated it. And then, you know, eventually Master Reyes, you know, his system became a more eclectic system because he saw the growth of, you know, let's say jiu-jitsu or how important is wrestling or how important is, you know, all these other combative sports that are now, you know, part of everyday training, you know, in my opinion, as far as self-defense goes, or it should be. But he saw it very early on. So we had the appreciation of an instructor that didn't just see it one way and a linear way. And that's actually one of the reasons why I think that he's been around so long, because he's always adapted and evolved and continued to evolve as an instructor, as a student. When I think about Master Reyes, it's like, you know, there's fighters, there's fighters and there's martial artists, right? And they're different. Right? Doesn't mean you can't fight if you're a martial artist. It doesn't mean you are a martial artist if you're a fighter, you know? And I think that's the one thing when I was actually teaching, I would tell my students, like, look, because you're a great fighter doesn't mean you're a martial artist. And they're like, you know, they're confused. Well, what does that mean? And my thought process on that is like, look, you know, if you can walk the talk and you can, you know, integrate these life skills into your everyday lifestyle, and you can do it over a period of long, of decades of training, and you can grow, then I think that's, to me, that's what a martial artist is. It's like, you know, you should have the respect, you should have the courtesy, you should have the indomitable spirit and the perseverance. Yes, these are all things that fighters do as well. But, you know, there's a certain life skills that I think martial arts teaches that, you know, is not just fighting and combative sport. My expertise really, inside the school is, you know, Master Reyes' system. But outside the school, I got to see some of the best fighters, got to know some of the best martial artists, got to know some of the best fighters in the world, and got to spend a lot of time with them. And everybody's different, you know, everybody's different. But, you know, it all goes back to that era when, you know, 1985, I think, is the March of 85 is when I did my first fight.
Okay.
Meaning I was a promoter with my partners were a gentleman by the name of Rick Hines and Master Reyes and Quantum Tony, Quantum Ernie and Quantum Tony. And we had a company called West Coast Productions. And we did a fight that was at the San Jose Civic Auditorium, very small kickboxing show because there was no arena at that time. And it was Jorge Angott versus Felipe Garcia. These were, you know, 130-pound fighters. And it was under the PKA banner, under Joe Corley's PKA banner. So Joe Corley's, you know, would sanction it. And then sometimes they'd bring ESPN in and they would film your show and then they would leave. And you had the benefit of saying, hey, we're going to be on TV. All your fighters, your undercard fights, that sort of thing would be on television. And it was under the PKA banner at that time when we very, very first started very early on. And we had a fighter, Sam Montgomery, fighting at the time, who was a very, you know, very popular martial artist here, became a kickboxer, fought in Japan, fought here, fought for us. We had a fighter named Francis Farley, Chris Brinkerhoff. And then we also had a fighter that actually was a martial arts student of mine, and his name was Javier Mendez, right? So it shows you how long ago this was. And, you know, the thing with Javier and my relationship really started as he walked into my school. And I think with his brother, who was very talented, Javier was super talented. I mean, he could, they call him Thunder for a reason because he hit so hard. Mm-hmm. And he came in and he wanted to join class. And so, you know, a lot of these fighters that have come from the Bay Area really have come from that gym, particularly. Like if you think about all the great fighters in MMA in the last 10 years or 20 years, I mean, think about how many champions that gym has pumped out. And it's really, I would say, due to, you know, Javier and Crazy Bob and that whole fighter ecosystem that kind of self-perpetuates greatness. Yes. You know, like first was a guy named Brian Johnson who fought in the UFC. Okay. And then Brian had a relationship and Frank Shamrock came in, right? So it was Javier and Frank Shamrock. And this is when AK first, you know, began. This is like in the 90s, I believe. Because Javier said to me one day as a student, and he said, hey, you know, I really enjoy martial arts, but I don't really want to do traditional martial arts anymore. I want to go become a fighter. And I said, okay, well, you know, why don't you let me promote you? And so I was his promoter for, you know, his professional fight career. And then he opened a gym and, you know, and then all these fighters started coming to him because he had such great skills and striking. And then, but with Brian Johnson and Frank Shamrock, and then BJ Penn was there for a while. Then came Josh Koscheck, Mike Swick, and then came Josh Thompson, and then Luke Rockhold, Cain Velasquez, Daniel Cormier, Khabib Nurmagomedov, now Usman Nurmagomedov. It's like all these great fighters in this gym. And honestly, I used to sit there and watch them do fighter training class. And it was like, this is a pay-per-view event, really, right? Yeah. I don't need to spend $50 or $60 to watch Daniel Cormier spar Cain Velasquez back in the day. They fight each other 3 days a week, you know, and you get to check it out. And but to see Javier's evolution and as an instructor, as a fighter, as a martial artist first, as a fighter, as a gym owner, and then have all these great champions and continue to have great champions. It's been a really special relationship because he and I really are, you know, I would say like he's one of my best friends. We grew up together. On my 21st birthday, he actually was the one that took me out, right? So that's how long we go back. Wow. I mean, it's like decades and decades and decades. And he's had such great success. And when you think about the Bay Area, I think of, you know, Master Reyes. I think of AKA. I think of, you know, there's other schools in the Bay Area, like Fairtex was here for a while. And you have, but before that, there was, you know, a lot of Kaji Kimbo schools and a lot of, you know, just very, very good martial arts in the Bay Area for such a long time. But the ones that have been able to continue it and sustain it and grow it and really make an impact in the community, really, I think it's Master Raisa Schools, and I look at Javier with AKA.
Sure. No, the Bay Area is such a gem, you know, of martial arts that, you know, and then you extend out a little bit further. Stockton's not too far away. And then the Diaz brothers and the Gracies coming from there. And mm-hmm. you go up north to San Francisco with Gilbert up there and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So it's such a scene. I remember going there to watch the kickboxing fights and the really in the beginning when I'm, you know, that was over 20 years ago when I'm starting to make the transition between, okay, here's traditional martial artists I've been at that time to say, okay, let's see what the sport side is, what's it about. And that's what I'd love to talk to you a little bit further about is, you know, you mentioned two very important things and you said there's a fighter and there's a martial artist and how can each aspect help feed the other? And how important is adaptability? Because adaptability is the ultimate superpower if there ever was. We listened to Bruce Lee, be like water and mm-hmm. flow. And he's talking mm-hmm. about how well can you adapt? You mm-hmm. said Master Reyes mm-hmm. adapting, Javier adapting. In your career, mm-hmm. you've been adapting. And sometimes people get fixed in their ways and they get fixed, they get set and they get rigid. Mm-hmm. And it's in that rigidity becomes weakness. But if you look at AKA's evolution, going from kickboxing, then Frank Shamrock came there, right? And I think mm-hmm. when I got there, I was there only for a little bit of time. But when I got there, I remember there's a big, Frank Shamrock had just beaten Tito Ortiz. And at that time, you're like, oh, wait, there's the wrestling happening here. There's a jiu-jitsu happening. Yeah. There's a Muay Thai happening here. And then they're putting it together. Which I was like, it blew my mind at that time.
I'll tell you, you know, when I think about Frank and Javier working together, was really the pivotal moment in that gym, I believe. Okay. Because you had such a great submission fighter already fighting in Pancrase and Brian Johnson too. But Frank, you know, he had a big spotlight on him for a long time, big star in MMA, and Javier was teaching him how to strike. Because you already had the submission game and the pancreas game. So Javier says you had a fight then. The big fight with Tito was in 1999. So you were probably there in 98, 97.
I came right after like 2001. Okay. I think it was 2001, 2002. But the poster was on the whole wall back there at AKA was a shot of them two fighting.
It was a fight, yeah. That was a very, very, you know, in the history of MMA, a lot of people, you know, look back and say that was one of the first mega fights was Frank Shamrock versus, you know, Tito Ortiz. And when I think about the evolution of the combat sport part of this, right, to me, this is how I feel. Yes. Is in Gracie comes over in 1993, right? And they start the Ultimate Fighting Championship with the Gracie family. Eventually Bob Meyerowitz got involved. But they were way ahead of the time on the ground game because a lot of people were doing more traditional karate and not so much to the ground. But what the Gracies taught everybody, including my instructor and me and everybody else, was like, okay, we better start learning how, you know, to do some jiu-jitsu and have some knowledge because around here, we didn't have access to Hoyce, but we had Ralph Gracie here.
Yeah.
Cesar Gracie. And Caesar was the birthplace of the Rat Pack, right? Or the Rat Pack. Yeah, Rat Pack. So basically it's Nate, Nick, Jake Shields, Gilbert Melendez. That's all from the Caesar Gracie lineage. And then so we had access to some jiu-jitsu and I remember going into the martial arts school and to see Master Reyes, and he was putting on his shoes. He's like, I'm on my way to Pleasant Hill to go work out with Caesar Gracie. Right. Like I'm gonna and he had his white belt on. Right. Here is a, you know, 9th degree black belt or 8th degree black belt at the time. And my instructor since the '70s has been doing martial arts his whole life. And he has the humility and the humbleness to say, okay, I'm gonna put my white belt on and I'm gonna go learn from these guys. And that's what he did. And Tony Thompson went to Pleasanton, I think twice a week or once a week, and he started learning, you know, about jiu-jitsu and the art form, because a lot of people were behind, not just in the fighting aspect, but in the school aspect of combat sports, right? So Gracie comes, he starts taking everybody out. And then came the wrestler, Mark Kerr, Mark Coleman,
Yes.
Don Fry, Dan Severin, right? Killers, Dan Henderson. These guys were killers, and they started, let's say, doing damage on some of the jiu-jitsu guys that were smaller. And at that time, as you know, there was no weight classes, and there was no, you know, I think they eventually put in rounds, but there's a time where there was none of that. It was basically a martial arts fight.
Yeah.
So you had the jiu-jitsu era. A couple of years later, the wrestler comes. And what it taught everybody is like, look, I better go learn jiu-jitsu, and I better go learn wrestling, you know, and because this is going to be an important piece of this. Because if your opponent can take you down at will, like he's an Olympic level opponent, you better have some really slick jiu-jitsu, right? But you're not, your striking goes out the window, right? At that point, it goes out the window. So I would say mid-90s, late 90s, you have the wrestling era.
Yes.
And then came along Maurice Smith, who signed to the UFC. And then Maurice Smith starts knocking people out with head kicks, you know, or beating Mark Coleman and beating these guys because he could get taken down, get standing back up, but his striking was so good that he was a level above. Now the wrestler's saying, okay, I better go learn how to strike. The jiu-jitsu guy is saying, I better go learn how to strike. And then after that era came, I would say, let's say the GSP era, which is like the person that puts it all together, the martial artist that puts it all together, right? And so what you've seen is a scientific study of all these different art forms over the last, you know, since 93, you know, 20 something years, you know, or 20, how was how 93?
Almost 30.
30 years. Yeah, yeah. Jesus, man, time flies. So you got 30 years of scientific study of what martial arts work.
Yes.
And what does not work. And yeah, every style has its benefits and every person has his own attributes that he brings to the table. But all in all,
yes,
you know, you better learn how to have some wrestling in your game. You need to have jiu-jitsu in your game. You need to be a striker in your game. And the last part of this piece, a puzzle really, is how does it all come together? Because if you're doing one and it doesn't flow into the next, you're going to have a hard time. Your transitioning has to be smooth. Your transitioning has to be effortless, you know? And so when I think back, that's why I'm such a big fan of Bruce Lee still, right? It's like, this guy just baffles me because in the 60s, he was putting it all together, his system of punching and striking and grappling. The opening scene of Enter the Dragon, right, is him in his MMA shorts,
yes,
his MMA open finger boxing gloves.
Yeah.
The very first step is like a footwork step of movement, you know, showing like a fencing movement, right? And then he grapples, he punches, he kicks, he submits. So it's you know, I'm thinking, how did he put this together back then when it was taboo? It was complete taboo. And, you know, it was something where you just didn't, styles didn't cross back then, right? Yeah. So over the last 30 years, we've had the scientific benefit of seeing what techniques work and how do you put it all together, and it's been kind of laid out for you. And to me, when you think about the last 30 years of combat sports and what's effective and what's not effective, look, it's not a street fight, but it's as close to real self-defense, like, you know, as you can get, right? Yeah. Like, is there different eye pokes or different groin strikes, you know, things that you do, maybe a street fight that you don't do in MMA? Yes, because there's rules, there's rounds, there's weight classes, you know, and so I think that when I look at today's MMA fighter, it's if they're not a complete fighter, they're going to be in trouble, you know, because somebody's going to have that whole thing put together. And I watch Usman Nurmagomedov in Seattle, and I'm not sure if you have a chance to see it, but please check it out, because he fought another kid really tough.
Yeah,
and he's more of a Thai boxer, kickboxer. Starts kicking him, but he goes in and he hooks him by the heel, takes him down. But while he's going down, he does a reverse guillotine and chokes him out. Right, all before he landed on the ground.
Yeah.
Right, so his transitions are very smooth, and he's super talented. And to me, that's what I'm looking for, is like, can the guy strike? Can he wrestle? Does he have a ground game? Can he do submissions? I mean, you know, coming from the lineage of Habib, you can imagine, like, they're all, you know, training like crazy at AKA and or wherever they're in Dubai right now training, and they're, you know, Javier goes with them now, and it's great training everywhere. But that to me is like you know, this is what I think the next 10 years, the next 20 years is, like, all these individual styles that have been proven to be effective, combine them. But now you have, the fighter has to be, have good transitions and be smooth in between those different styles of fighting. That's going to be the next 15 or 20 years, you know? And that's really my opinion.
I think you put that so succinctly, because I solemnly believe that as well. You know, it's in the transition. If you take a look and see what Bruce Lee is talking about, is flow, right? What is flow? Going from one thing to another thing to another thing, not the individual starting or the ending points. And I think what ends up happening is that sometimes, which we saw in the evolution, that first there was one block versus another block. Okay, stand up versus ground. All right, so then people started to get better. Then there were more blocks. Wrestling block got added, and then a jiu-jitsu block and a boxing block and a Muay Thai block, let's say. And then people had their own individual things that they were coming from, adding that block to it. But now there's a set thing that all those blocks have merged together, that who's the person that takes those different molecules per se and makes one complete thing that's indistinguishable. That wait, is he doing kickboxing now? Is he grappling now? Did he do a takedown now? Or is he back to, can he go from the kick to? So I think when we can take that style out of it almost, and now we're back to that concept that Bruce Lee was saying, the style of no style, because we're truly there and seeing it's the transition, who's got the elegant transition and the ability now to feel. So when we start talking about transitions now, the element of, can we feel what's happening? Can we feel the tensions, the pressures? Those skills start to come up. The ability to, I think, still the mind comes up, and how can we let go of what's happening and totally be in that present moment starts to give the fighter the advantage, over their opponent.
Because I will tell you, even from my viewpoint, running a professional MMA league that has 250 fighters, 300 fighters, I would say most of them still fight in these little linear blocks. The transition hasn't happened yet. And then the top 20% are the ones that can transition, you know, between each system and be effective. And like I said, like the wrestler, you punch the wrestler, what's he going to do? He's going to take you down. Yep. Right? He's going to go right back to take you down, right? And the jiu-jitsu guy, he's going to want to fight on his back, or, you know, he's not going to want to stand and strike with you, right? And same thing with a striker. You know, it's like he's going to keep it standing up. The wrestler's going to want to take him down. The jiu-jitsu guy wants to get him on his back. So people go back to what they know best. But I think the next, you know, evolution will be the melding of all those different systems. And I saw it with Usman. It was beautiful. I mean, this guy kicked him, and when he went for the takedown, what was amazing was he had this choke in there before the guy landed on the ground. I was like, wow, I've never seen that before. Usually they hit the ground and they jump on him, and then they ground upon him, and they try to work their technique. But he did it so fast, you just couldn't. The guy had no time to respond. That's so cool. That to me is the future of MMA fighting. And the one thing I'm really glad about, coming from a striking style, you know, originally, is, you know, when Morris came and showed, hey, you need to learn how to strike. Then we saw some really great strikers, you know, Stephen Thompson, Kung Lee, people that could really do damage with their striking ability. And I don't mean just punching. I'm talking mostly the kicks, right? I mean, I don't think since Kung Lee we've seen a fighter that could do a back kick and take someone out, the way he did, right? It was unbelievable. 100%. I mean, to me, that's where this has to go. Yeah. You know, these people have to know that traditional martial arts has a place in here, and this is where you could do it. And so that to me will be the next 20-year transition of the fighter growth and the fighter evolving into the next level in MMA.
I'm so with you. I love that breakdown. You know, I think the traditional martial artist listening, I think what ends up happening sometimes is that you're training against other traditional martial artists. You're building attributes and timing and things of that nature and techniques and defenses based on what you would face in your dojo or in your style. Mm-hmm. But the moment that you start to open up and you really, I think it's something you said earlier, is if we can approach our growth with humility, I think that's where it really starts. Is like, can we go here and say, okay, now let me take this other block, maybe it's a jiu-jitsu or grappling, and how do I start to interface? What do I know here with them? Because their timing, their angles, their distance, their pressure, their mentality is going to be different. And unless we have that experimentation phase come in, then only then we start to see, oh, wow, that's really good. I need to add that in. Oh, this is the moment when I can do this. And I think that goes back to what you were saying with regards to the evolution of the mixing. But at the same time, I think with the mixing, you have an opportunity to experiment. And I think we live in the greatest era of martial arts that we can go and see, is my takedown defense really going to work? I think really going to work? Right. Well, we could just go pay a high school wrestler $20, put on a motorcycle helmet and give it a try, right? And
or you can go to AKA and they'll be happy to work out with you, and then, you know. 100%. But here's the one thing, and this is very interesting. And I was telling my friends the other day, I said, you know, like Neiman Gracie just fought another fighter, Gyoti Yamaguchi from Brazil. And Neiman Gracie is a, you know, jiu-jitsu, you know, master. And Yamaguchi is a high level jiu-jitsu guy too. And I said to my guys, they're not going to go to the ground. This is not going to go to the ground because they negate each other, yes. Right? Think about that. So then now it becomes who's a better striker. The better striker was Yamaguchi, and he knocked out Neiman, right? And same thing with the wrestler. When the wrestler is at such a high level, because it's one thing about like local level wrestling, but what about Olympic level wrestlers? 100%. Like that, you know, like Aaron Pico's of the world or Daniel Cormier's of the world. It's like you're talking about a super high level of wrestling. But when they fight each other, these super high level wrestlers, sometimes the wrestling negates itself. They don't go for the takedown. Yeah. Then it becomes a striking match, right? Or they're looking for the submission because they know they can't out-wrestle this guy. Or if they do, it's going to come back on them. And so they choose not to take it to the ground, if you know what I mean. It's like 100%. We had a fighter, Logan Sorley, and super wrestler. And he fought our champion, Amosov, at the time. And Amosov is a great wrestler. Dan Lambert from American Top Team, which is another great camp, he told me, Amosov is the best wrestler he's seen in his gym, you know, since he opened it. Wow. Think about that statement. That's a powerful statement, right? And Amosov is a fighter that's in the Ukraine right now fighting against the Russians, and he's our champion. But now I think he's going to come out and do a fight and maybe go back and trying to work it all out. But he is wrestling at such a high level, and so was Sterling. So you know what? They didn't wrestle. It became a jiu-jitsu and striking fight. It became more of a striking fight because they knew it's just going to negate each other. So that's something a lot of fans don't realize. Like they think, oh, this guy's a jiu-jitsu guy. And then, you know, he's a jiu-jitsu guy. Oh, of course it's going to go to the ground and somebody's going to submit somebody. And I said, no, I don't think so. I think it's not going to go to the ground and they're going to try to use their other skills, you know, to take it out. And it goes back to, okay, so if you don't have it all, you're going to have somebody that does have it all that's going to beat you one day. And that's how I feel about that.
Yeah, no, it's really fascinating because now it really is truly becoming a chess match, a really true combat chess match where you know, the strategy and then, you know, you can go, you know, Sun Tzu says you can have a plan before you go into battle, but how well can you let go of that plan and adapt in that situation to what you're seeing? Becomes the crucial part. And I think just like you mentioned, and, you know, back to Bruce Lee, well, if you have a boxer, two boxers going, then the guy who can do the takedown, and you don't box a boxer, you really might need to wrestle him. You don't kickbox a kickboxer if you're both kickboxers. Mm-hmm. How do you use that other skill to once again adapt, as you had mentioned earlier? Adaptability is the key.
Yeah. And you know what? I tell this to my friends all the time that are very much into, let's say, studying one style of wrestling or jiu-jitsu or whatever. I said, look, this is how I feel personally. It's like, look, in a situation, let's say in a bar or you're in a fight, they're going to take, of course, the fight's going to go to the ground at some point, right? But what you don't know is you don't know if he has two friends sitting around watching this, right? And you're going to go down there and try to grapple this guy and while his friend kicks you in the face. I mean, like, you have to have striking too. You have to have it all. Even in a self-defense situation, like you better fight, you know, you better be able to keep your opponent distance and do damage striking. And if it goes to the ground, do your thing, but be very aware that, you know, it's not an all grappling or all wrestling or all striking world that you know, to survive in today's craziness, you know, I think you have to have it all.
Yes, sir.
This episode is brought to you by Martial Arts Dingo, your best source nationwide for Shurido brand premium karate products. That's martialartsdingo.com. Today we're announcing the arrival of rare ceramic figurines from Shurido direct from Okinawa, Japan. These hand-sculpted, hand-painted, and hand-glazed clay figures are very rare and individually unique. Standing approximately 8 inches tall, each figure is posed in traditional karate stance. Their bodies denote strength and power, their eyes deep focus in concentration. They make a great gift for your sensei or for yourself. Uniforms wear out, these figurines will last a lifetime. After they're gone, they may not come around again. Find them now at Martial Arts Dingo, your best source for Shurido brand products and all martial arts training gear. Use promo code BBPODCAST02 for 10% off $100 or more through June 1st.
And back to what you said, and that having it all is the, when you have it all, the ability to transition, because in that street fight now, guess what happens? You get taken down, you got to get back up because you don't want to stay down. Right. You don't know his friends are coming. Then there might be weapons involved. And there's many different scenarios that I think what happens is it's fear comes in the uncertainty. And if your certainty would lie in your ability to adapt and change is where you would find your certainty, because in the unknown, you don't know what's going to happen. But if you train your ability to change and transform with the pressures and tensions happening, I think that's where that real freedom of martial arts really comes in. That's what I love about it more than anything, the art part.
Yeah, yeah. It is an art form. And I think the transition is at the highest level of mastery. When I think about, you know, MMA or combat sports or just martial arts in general, it's a transition of how well you can transition is that's going to be, to me, when you can master this, the art of MMA is really the transition point.
How does that cross over to life in general?
Boy, I tell you, there's so many similarities between, you know, to me, between martial arts and everyday life. Because one thing my instructor told me, Master Reyes told me, he said, you know, don't be a black belt in the school. Be a black belt in life. Mm. Right. So the lessons that I learn inside that gym, I carry with me and how I live my life. But I also carry it in how I do business, right? And so to me, this is a martial arts journey that's lasted for, you know, 40 years, let's say, or even longer, because as a student of martial arts, it's been going on, let's say, 50 years now as a student. But as far as like how you, you know, carry yourself, how you live your life, how you apply that to business, it's all one. To me, it's all one. There's no separation, you know, and you can't put your uniform on and then go teach class and preach one thing. And then you come out and then you're doing bad business and you're taking advantage of people. And you're, because I think the karma has a way of circling back, you know, like the life has this flow of energy, right? And it all comes back, you know, that's what I really believe, that it all comes back. And so I think that the skills that you learn there, you know, you apply it to, you know, your everyday life, you know, how you carry yourself, how you deal with personal issues, how you deal with public issues, and then, you know, integrate that into business. Right. And so to me, that's something that I've always tried to maintain. Like, is it a perfect, you know, wheel or scenario? No, it's not, but it's something that I've always tried to apply. And this is my ecosystem. This is, you know, because I wanted to, you know, continue as a growth of a martial artist, and not just say, hey, when I go into the school, I put my uniform on, I'm that guy that should teach and that should, you know, that should learn and that, or, you know, go to classes and then have, you know, carry yourself a certain way, you know, carry yourself like that all the time. You know, it's not easy, because especially in business, right, where it gets a little rough out there, there's some rough waters, but you know, how you carry yourself through those rough waters really, I think, will teach a lot about you yourself as a person, right?
Yes, sir.
So
you know, I would love to ask for some advice for the audience listening. And you know, being in the cage is chaos, business is chaos, and life is chaos. How do you find that stillness, you know, in that chaos, and how do you share that with your employees and your fighters?
You know, the one thing I feel the culture of, let's say, Strikeforce MMA or Strikeforce Kickboxing before that, or Bellator MMA, it's like the culture of our company is very much like the culture of when I had a martial arts school, or when the culture of when I was Master Reyes a student and going to class, I mean, one thing Master Reyes always treated us was like family, you know? So how he treated us wasn't like, hey, you're my student, or now you're my instructor, or, you know, like he really treated us like a family. So if you come to Bellator now and you talk to the fighters, you talk to the staff, I think you'll hear the word, hey, this is more like a family than a corporation, right? And that's not always easy to do, is, you know, in this business, because it's a tough business sometimes. And there is business ups, there's business downs, there's business, you know, there's all kinds of crazy things that happen in this world, especially in MMA. It's a different world. Mm-hmm. And, but I want to maintain, you know, like who I am and what I've learned from the schools and implement that into business and everyday life. And I think after, like, you know, being in the fight business for almost 40 years, it's like, I think that I feel like I've seen every scenario at least, you know, 10 times, right? So nothing's going to shock me to the point where I'm like, oh my God, you know, like, it's not my first dance, right? So, you know, I think I bring a certain calmness to the event and to the company, as, you know, as a leader of the company, that I have done this before, and I've done this for a very long time. And, you know, it's, you know, when these scenarios happen, how I react, I think people are watching, and I think that's why they like working here, or that's why they like fighting for me, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's still a business, but it's how we react to the business and how we react to all these scenarios that really, I think, is the most important.
Yes, sir. You know, I think you said something, so many vital things there, but the key that everybody's watching. I think people are always watching us, whether it's our students, our family, our employees, even our opponents, and how we carry ourselves goes across. And from the top down, from what I've observed from the outside, is that calm approach from the top down. You know, leadership calm comes down, it brings everybody down. But if leadership is getting, antsy, anxious, stressed out, then it starts to raise that vibration up. And I love the way you explain that, because it's that family, right? That family atmosphere, because it seems to me that you really care about your fighters, and you care about their, not only their development, but their well-being, but you care about them. And that comes across, and that makes sense, that you're building a culture of a family.
Yeah. And if you think about it, you know, here are these amazing athletes that spent their whole life becoming this fighter, you know, and now they're stepping into a cage with another fighter. There's a referee. They lock the door with a pin behind them, and it's mano a mano. Now, as a martial artist, if you can't love that, and you can't respect that, and you can't see that, hey, these are the stars of this company, right? And they should be treated as stars of the company. And I can't say that I just one day discovered it and said, okay, this is how it's going to be. I was working for K1 at the time, Master Ishii's company in Japan. And we did the fights here in Las Vegas. Not here, but in Vegas, we did fights twice a year. But I would go back to Japan and go to all the big events there, which were spectacular. And they were unbelievable. It was just like a pivotal moment in my fight career. But he said to me one time, he said, you know, you're talking about Peter Arts and Ernesto Hoost and like his, you know, and I saw how he treated them. And I said, Concho, you know, like in, I said, Concho, how does this work? Like, you know, these are big stars in Japan and, you know, you manage the relationships. And that's what he said to me. He said, these are the stars of K1. These are the stars. They're the ones that step into the ring and fight. They have the Bushido, you know, they have the samurai spirit. You know, it's like, it's not about us, like being you and me, like him and me, it's about them and how we support them. And that's really, I said, that's it. To me, that's really how I feel, because, you know, you're a martial artist and you respect these guys that go in there and do this, because you know how much hard work it is to get to that point, that elite level, to get to that point, elite level to be going there. And with MMA, it's a whole different level, because I said the psychology of you versus them or him, you know, you two fighting, one referee to stop it, and someone's going to lock the gate behind you. If that doesn't send a message, a powerful message, I don't know what does. I mean, to me, we take it for granted, but to me, that's a symbol, right? These are warriors at the highest level going into battle, you know, at the highest level, and whoever wins wins. Like it's you know, we can't figure out who's going to win. We're just guessing, but they're the warriors. They're the Bushido. They are the ones that had the warrior spirit. So to me, that's, I learned that from Mr. Ishii. I'll never forget it. And that's been one of my philosophies since then about how I look at, you know, our athletes and how we treat our athletes.
I love hearing that. That's the martial part, the martial art part. Yeah. I think that the honor, the integrity, the appreciation, because, you know, to add on, you're locked in a cage. You know, pretty much anything goes except for a few rules mm-hmm, here and there. Mm-hmm. But then there's also, I think, the part that people don't realize is there's people watching. You're not in the corner of a room getting in a fight with somebody that nobody sees, or in an alley somewhere nobody sees. You got people watching you. My teacher said, you know, he said, the two biggest fears that you have to get over right away is the fear of being hit and the fear of being humiliated. And there's mm-hmm. some people that are not afraid of being hit, but the fear of humiliation mm-hmm. like, stalls them so much. And then, of course, vice versa. But I think that that's the other part, that being an athlete, or that they don't understand, you know, that you're on the stage, you got millions of people watching, but you got thousands of people watching. There's a difference with the energy of them coming on you also at the same time.
Think about this. Like, we might have, let's say, 10,000 people at the San Jose Arena here watching a fight, you know, with Pitbull and AJ McKee, let's say. Yeah. But, you know, we're broadcast in 63 countries around the world, right? And so it's, you're talking about millions of people, tens of millions of people watching this one fight around the world. And then guess what they do after they see the fight?
Yeah.
You know, and they're just letting him have it, right? Because, you know, these are fans, and, you know, the internet is, it can be very negative sometimes, you know, but they're in there, they're just, and these fighters have to read all this stuff, or they read all this stuff, and they, you know, it really, I think, gets to a lot of these guys to the point where sometimes they cut off social, you know, following and get out of that whole world, because, it's tough, because if you lose or you win or you do, man, they're under such scrutiny. It's really, I think, as a you know, like as a friend, some of these fighters that are really close friends, it really gets to them. It starts eating at them. And my advice to them is like, look, just get off of it. You don't need it. You know, like, you have your own journey, man. They're just, you know, they don't know you. They don't know your work and your commitment, and, you know, they just see what they see on the air in that one fight. But what have you done for the last 20 years to get to this point? And you know, like I said, the internet can be a very tough place, and so that's what the fighter's under. You know, he's got the psychological warfare of these keyboard warriors, you know, that he's got to deal with too after the fight's over.
Yeah, so and before pain.
Yeah, and before.
Time, right?
Oh, and man, so. Yeah, it's just a different, like. Listen, I'm older now, and it's a different world, you know. Like, when I was promoting in the 80s, it was like I'd go from school to school, pass out tickets or vouchers, or, you know, like, you know, it was very much like, you know, like a old fashioned business. Now yeah. it's a global business, and it's instant, and, you know, the broadcast deals and the streaming deals and has changed everything, and the internet support and the, you know, Instagram followers and all the, you know, Facebook, you know, fans. It's like, it's just being, you know, you're speaking to millions of people now, millions, tens of millions of people.
Man, you know, I hope there's a book in the works. Yeah.
book. I always said, like, I would do it one day. The day is not right yet, but there will be a time. There's some people might get their feelings hurt. I don't want to get in that business. But you know, I think some people would find it to be fascinating, like some of the stories and just the people I've met along the way. And, you know, it's been just a great journey, because I look at it like I'm a fan of these fighters. I'm a fan of these people. I'm a fan of martial arts. I love martial arts. I see my instructor, like, you know, twice a month still, you know, and I take him out to lunch, or we have conversations, and, like, you know, here's somebody that was a very, you know, important part of my development as an adult, and developed the building blocks and the life skills that it took me to get to this point with this company, you know? So to me, without that background of traditional martial arts and being with Master Reyes, I don't know if I would be where I'm at today, you know? So I'm very thankful, very grateful. And you know, it's something that I don't take lightly, and I always give him his due respect, because one thing about him, man, is like, he's been an instructor that's always walked the talk, you know, like when I look back in the 70s to now, I've never seen him out of shape. I've never not seen him not working out, like, you know, lifting weights 3 days a week, doing cardio 4 days a week, teaching martial arts. Even today with, you know, he just had his 75th birthday, and he's still like, I go in the school, he's still teaching. He's still doing, you know, like his thing, you know, you know, he's one of the early adapters of dieting and, you know, this, and lifting weights and, you know, and like doing cardio kickboxing, like the Billy Blanks thing. We did Taibo way before Billy was popular. And what I mean by that was, we were friends with Billy Blanks.
Yeah.
So, okay. So Billy and I think I met Billy at a karate tournament with Toki Hill
back in
early 80s, and he was competing. Wow. Right. And so we became friends. So way before his fame with Taibo and all that, he would come to San Jose because there's a relationship with my instructor, and he would teach us Taibo. Like, you know, like this is, he would take us through a class of Taibo. And all I remember was like, oh my God, this guy is in shape. Like, he is just a monster, man. And he got, I think I could only do like half of his class the first time. I just was not in that good shape. But he and my instructor loved him, and you know, they had this lifelong relationship. But I guess that's my point, is like, you know, my instructor is somebody that still walks the talk to this day. And that's what I love about him, is like, I don't look back and say, oh, well, you know, he was acting like this, but he was actually not, you know, like, I've heard some other stories that I don't want to get into that maybe the instructors didn't walk the talk. And so I'm just thankful that his giving of martial arts was very pure and very, you know, like organic, and, you know, we get the benefit of it all. And I think that, my friends that I have from back then, like Soo Jin Lee, George Chung, Gary Nakahama, you know, Margie, these are like, we still hang out all the time. Like, I still see George all the time, you know, as much as we can, we're traveling, but Sujin and I, we golf 3 days a week or twice a week. Like, these are people I feel the most comfortable with them, to be honest, because I grew up with these guys, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's been lifelong relationships that I've developed inside that school that I just love. And, you know, people come in and out of your life sometime, but that core group is still intact. It's still there. And it's been almost 50 years. That's the crazy thing about it. And I'm still hanging out with them. You know, I must still like them.
No, that's amazing. You know, that is very inspiring, because that, you know, you guys are a living example. I'm, by the way, I'm going to have Master George Chung on the show as well. Pretty soon. I just spoke to him. We were doing a project for Combat Go, and it's just fascinating to me, because it really gets me excited. You know, it gets me excited because that's what we want to create. I think that is what I want to create from this podcast, or in my career. That's what we want to create, is those long lasting relationships. And there's a question I wanted to ask you. I know we're running out of time. Is could you tell us about Grandmaster Reyes's POM statement?
Yeah, for years, you know, Master Reyes has always said, you know, POM, which means power and mastery, right? And what he meant by that is, don't be afraid to go learn from masters,
okay,
to learn from true masters, whether it's, you know, in let's say, in food and diet, or in sports nutrition, or, you know, motivational, you know, speeches, or, you know, and I'm thinking about people that he's brought into our life. Which one was Anthony Robbins, which was a very powerful motivator. And he changed my life, actually. And after going to his seminar you know, I learned a lot from Anthony Robbins. So one thing I learned from him the most was, don't procrastinate. Do not procrastinate. You know, don't be that guy that's going to be, oh, I'll do it. You know, if you want to do it, go now. That's, you know, and he's had a lot of other great gifts, but I think to me, that was the one thing. And, you know, I was afraid to open my first school before I went to that seminar. After a seminar, 3 months later, I was up and running.
Nice.
I had a martial arts school, and I was, you know, that's the school that Javier came to, you know, that, that started this whole thing, right? So, but, you know, whether it's, you know, people in different fields that are masters of what they do, go learn from the best masters that you can in life and see what works for you. Just like, you know, JKD, it's like what works for you. And not everything might work for you, but take some things that along the way that you can move forward in, right? So that's to me, that's what power mastery meant for many, many years. And then at the 75th birthday, he said that. He said, you know, I talk about power, POM, power mastery, many years, and I've taught my students to go learn and, you know, and be humble students in life and you know, absorb all this knowledge, right? He says, but now, you know, as I'm getting older, POM means, for me personally, meaning him, was peace of mind. You know, can I go to sleep every night and have peace of mind? Do I know my kids are okay and I have everything set up, you know, like peace of mind? And so that's to me, that's what, you know, it's evolved, that POM has evolved just like he has over all these years. And it went from being one from the greatest masters, which I think he has, and he has been a great, you know, martial arts master himself. And then now to peace of mind, you know, it's like, you know, that's a powerful statement to me, you know, being, you know, 75th birthday. Now he looks at life a little different than he was when I met him when he was 27 years old, when I met Master Reyes, I think. And so it's like the growth but it's just, you know, I was just like, man, this is such a powerful statement to me because, you know, as I guess as you get older and, you know, like you think, okay, what is important to you? You know, what is the next, you know, part of your life going to be like? And I think that peace of mind is his next journey, you know? So, yeah, it's beautiful, man. Really, I was like going, wow, that's heavy, man. That's a heavy statement, right? Because for years, it's been about grow and learn and be a student and be humble and never have your cup so full of tea you can't learn, you know? And so, you know, and really, we bought into all that and we've learned so much from this. But now, you know, his mission's different. And so it made me go, that's a very powerful statement. And I'm going to start taking that in too, because, you know, you can get wrapped up into life and you get wrapped up into, you know, your business or your schools and you're to the point where, you know, you don't have peace of mind every night when you go to bed and you wake up and you're not in peace of mind, you know. But think about it. If you can stay in that space, that's a very powerful space to be in, is to have peace of mind every day.
I love it, man. I love it. Mm-hmm. There's one question I love to ask all my guests. The last question, if you don't mind, is what does a black belt mean to you?
You know, it's, you know, when you think about traditional martial arts and you think about the black belt, that's a symbolism of your accomplishment and your work and how hard you worked to get to this point. And you've accepted a certain level of, let's say, mastery, right? Being a black belt. But that's just the beginning. You know, like I got my black belt in the 70s. And it's come so far from that. It's like the journey just starts at that point. It means you have the basics, right? So how do you integrate that? How do you evolve that into, you know, don't be a black belt just in the school, be a black belt in life, be a black belt in business. How do you integrate all those, you know, things together? And how are you carrying yourself as a, you know, like say a master instructor of your own domain, you know? And so to me, it's like, that's been the lifelong journey. Yes, the black belt was important because it gave you a certain confidence, right? I remember when I got my black belt, oh, I thought I was the kid, you know? You know, I thought I was cool and, you know, I'm a black belt now. But really, that's just the beginning of the journey. You know, that's just, that means you're really a white belt at that point. You know, and where do you carry yourself for the next 30, 40, 50 years? And that's really the journey. It's like, you know, being a black belt in all three disciplines, life, business, and martial arts. Integrate those together. Then now you're, I would say you're a martial artist.
Boom. That's wonderful, sir. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much. I really look forward to meeting you in person. I could talk to you forever. This has been a fantastic experience, sir.
Yeah. And you know what? You'll find George Chong to be super funny. He's always been funny. I met George when I was 11. He was 12 years old. Okay. And wow. We traveled together. We were roommates during the demonstration team time. And, you know, he was a phenomenal martial artist. He still is. He does stuff now today. I'm like, Jesus, how do your legs not get ripped, you know, like doing these techniques? But he loves martial arts too. And he's, you know, had schools and he's done a lot of, but I'd be very interested to hear what he has to say about business and where he's headed. Cause you know, he is a brilliant, you know, martial artist, brilliant businessman, and he's put it all together. So I'm really excited about his future, and I love spending time with the guy because he's never down. He's never in, you know, like he's always in an upbeat mood, and he's doing what he wants to do, and he's going to be a great guest for you.
I'm really looking forward to that, sir. Well, I want to thank you. I hope you will come back on again, and we can continue our conversation. That would be really wonderful.
Yeah, I would love it. And please, we have a fight October 1st at the Long Beach Arena, where Pitbull is going to fight Adam Borks for a world championship fight. AJ McKee is going to fight. Aaron Pico is going to fight. See me on Showtime. But like I said, that in October 1st, that's my first time to step in that building since probably the early 80s when I stopped competing at the internationals, when at a Parker tournament. You know, like I guess we stopped going there for a while, and you know, it's been like, you know, 30 years since I've been there. So I'm excited to go back. I'm excited to go there and throw a fight. I mean, this is where Bruce was discovered, right? He did his famous demonstration there, and so much history and martial arts history in that building that I know I'm going to go. I'm going to feel it. It's going to be in the air. I'm very excited.
That's awesome. Well, sir, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you. I'd love to have you back on, and I look forward to meeting you in person one day.
Yes. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's been a real honor. Thank you, sir.
Us.
Thank you.
Take
us.
Care.
Martial arts is the greatest vehicle to discover human potential. My friends, follow, like, subscribe, and share this message with the world. The Black Belt Podcast can be found on Apple, Spotify, Google, and all major broadcasting outlets. I'm your host, Harinder Singh. And always remember, wherever you go, everyone's a little bit safer. Wherever you are, anyone in need has a friend. And when you come home, they're happy to see you. It's a good life.